Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jack Sneflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 15 of our Disney Bracket. This week, we'll be discussing 1940s Pinocchio and 2005's Chicken Little.
So, we don't really talk about how our bracket became our bracket. If, you know, listeners haven't listened to the first episode, let's remind everybody why these things are here.
There's a post on our Facebook that goes a little bit more in depth. But these films were seeded into the bracket based off of gross domestic box office, and everything's been adjusted for $2018 dollars. Some of these films have been released in theaters multiple times, which means they have artificially inflated their earnings, which is one of the reasons why Snow White is top seeded in the bracket. It's because it's been released about a dozen times.
Probably the same for Pinocchio.
Not quite as often, but it's been released about half a dozen times or so, at least.
Hmm.
And when it originally released in 1940, it was kind of considered a flop. So that's why these two films happen to be on this bracket. Surprisingly, Chicken Little was a slump ender for Disney. They hadn't had a number one opening since Dinosaur in 2000.
People didn't flock to Treasure Planet or Home on the Range, but they flocked here.
Lilo and Stitch, even.
Oh, God, you're right. That was then. Huh. But we'll get to the flocking later. First, let's do some summaries, then hit Pinocchio. So, in Pinocchio, Jiminy Cricket breaks into the house of Geppetto, a puppet maker, who has just finished a small boy. That night, he wishes on a star for the puppet to be a real boy, and a fairy hears him and awakens Pinocchio, appointing Jiminy as his conscience. The fairy tells Pinocchio that if he acts with virtue, he will become a real flesh and blood boy. Jiminy sucks at being Pinocchio's conscience and fails to keep Pinocchio from being sold to another puppeteer. When he doesn't come home, Geppetto goes looking for him. Jiminy and the Blue Fairy busts Pinocchio out of the puppet maker's cage, only for Pinocchio to be sold to a circus guy on a weird island where naughty boys turn into donkeys. Jiminy saves Pinocchio just in time. And they find out that Geppetto has been swallowed by a whale, and they get themselves swallowed to save him. By clever improvisation, Pinocchio gets the whale to open his mouth, and they sail on out, but Pinocchio dies in the process. The Blue Fairy decides that he has acted virtuously enough and turns him into a real live boy, and all live happily ever after, apart from all those boys who were on that island and turned into donkeys to be sold, who are never heard from again. The end.
In our second film, Chicken Little is still living through the backlash of his false alarm that the sky was falling from the year before. He is ostracized, and he and his father, Buck, are the laughingstock of Oaky Oaks. His friend, Abby Mallard, tries to help Chicken Little by getting him to talk about his feelings with his father, who didn't believe him the year before. Rather than do that, Chicken Little decides to follow in his father's footsteps and join the baseball team in order to bond and make him proud. He's benched the entire season until the final game. He manages to score a home run due to the other teams underestimating him and win the game, finally earning the respect of the town and his father. Rather than end the narrative here, later that evening, Chicken Little is hit by a piece of sky, making him panic that last year's incident will happen all over again. He and his friends investigate the tile, and when it kidnaps one of them, they discover that it's a cloaking tile for a UFO. The kids rescue their friend, but the aliens inside chase them. They escape the ship and head to the bell tower to warn the town. The bell rings, causing the town folk to gather, and the aliens to flee. The ship lifts off just before Chicken Little can show it to the crowd as proof, and is again ridiculed. His father once again fails to believe him. The next night, the aliens return, this time in force, as they accidentally left their child Kirby on Earth. Chicken Little explains everything to his father, but he assumes he won't believe him and leaves before Buck can respond. Chicken Little and friends attempt to return Kirby, but are unable to in the chaos of the invasion. Buck meets up with the kids, and he and his son finally talk. They execute a plan to climb to the top of City Hall to return Kirby, but are captured in the process. Kirby explains what happened to his parents, and the aliens apologize and repair the town. Chicken Little is lauded as a hero for saving the town, and most live happily ever after.
These films aren't, the strongest on our bracket.
They are not what you would call good.
That said, if you have fond memories of them, you're not a bad person. There are reasons to like these things. If you haven't seen them recently and want to keep those fond memories alive, maybe leave them in the past.
I will admit there's a lot of late 90s, early 2000s nostalgia that they play up in Chicken Little, mostly by cribbing from other films and popular music at the time, rather than anything it itself did.
This came out the same year as War of the Worlds, 2 years after Not Another Teen Movie, that kind of thing.
rather than start with our foul little friend. You should see the face Jackson is making at me. It's glorious. Let's go ahead and start with the wooden puppet.
Oh boy. I promised I'd be the positive one. So, like Snow White, this has a lot of those beautiful hand-painted backgrounds that use the layered background to create perspective and effect, and they're really gorgeous. I mean, knowing how much time has passed, a lot of them still really look very good, and there's a lot of detailed work put into a lot of these backgrounds, and I really appreciate that. In this day and age of having heavily CGI'd, heavily streamlined renderings, it's really cool to see brushstrokes that still have the tiny little mistakes that only a human hand can create. And that even goes to some of the animated bits. Like, you'll have a very full background with all the clocks that are moving, and they took the time to render all of them instead of just one or two.
The opening of the film were also treated to Jiminy Cricket singing, and unfortunately, it was very hard for me to not make the connection that this singing voice sounds exactly like Herbert the Pervert from Family Guy.
Anything your heart desires will come to you.
So that's fun. There's also this weird first-person hopping scene with Jiminy at the beginning of the movie, and we commented it didn't work in Doom, and it doesn't work here.
So the film is a, like, moralizing thing, like, I guess, dangerous lessons for boys, but in animated form, and some of them are fairly solid, like, not lying.
Don't smoke and drink because you're, like, 8.
Yeah, that. Take care of your family, even if they're kind of a weird family. Kiss your fish full of lips. Okay, last week we kind of got into the sexualization of Ariel and how it's weird, but it's reasonable for a 16-year-old to have a sexuality, even if it's a little weirdly presented in the film. Here, this is just a literal goldfish who's, like, making eyes at everybody and makes out with the cat at the end.
I'm not gonna slut-shame a fish, but Cleo is a bit cavalier in her love life.
I know where you go from that. Like, it's sort of...
There's a lot of questionable content here. There's a lot of characters who smoke in this film. There's the villains of the piece, Honest John, and the carriage driver who sells off the donkey-fied boys. Most of them are smoking cigars. And then it's also shown that the kids are smoking while they're on Pleasure Island. Once again, cigars. But we also have Geppetto, who smokes right before bed, but he's smoking a pipe. It's kind of odd that they go through this point of showing off this activity that is considered bad throughout the entire film, but they also have the kindly old man character also do it. It also doesn't make a whole lot of sense to smoke right before bed. Typically, nicotine is supposed to kind of have a stimulant effect.
The most reasonable solution is he's smoking some sort of marijuana to, like, deal with, like, the pains of old age. It's self-medication. He's healthy.
I mean, he also sleeps with a loaded blunderbuss under his pillow.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason that this old man did not have children or grandchildren or a significant other and just lives at home with his cat and fish. Geppetto is not a good parent.
No.
Let's go jump back a little bit. We see Honest John and...
Dopey.
Yeah, Dopey, the anthropomorphic cat.
Yeah.
They never explain why they're anthropomorphic animals either. They're just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other normal humans walking around. And then there's also the Dopey cat following around Honest John. But we also have Figaro, who is also a cat. And
so I have a theory about this. It kind of ties into other things happening in the movie. I was going to get into this later, but here we are now. So the blue fairy shows up to grant Liz a wish on a whim, apparently, with these weird rules. And Pinocchio is described as being made of pine, but when his nose grows really long when he lies, it has these, like,
almost cherry blossom-esque flowers.
Yeah, cherry blossom-esque flowers. So clearly, biology is being heavily messed up by the presence of the Fae. This is further heightened by that one guy who builds an entire circus with electronic lights in the, I guess, 1700s in the Swiss Alps, and he makes the children into donkeys. This is definitely some, like, high fairy shit, the kind of thing you see in, like, a Holly Black novel, which is why the biology is messed up. There's probably other people, like, wishing for talking cats and wishing for talking crickets or whatever, and that happens, and everyone's kind of just decided to go with it because they're like, no, if you don't question the fairies, they don't come for you.
I also completely refuse to believe that the overhead costs of running the carnival lights and rebuilding that house for the children to tear apart and all the free food and drinks and cigars for the kids is cheaper than just raising donkeys to sell.
It's gotta be magic. That's the only solution. He does have those weird shadow gremlin people. Some of the clocks would have been what you see in the house of some sort of serial killer. There's a clock where a turkey is constantly, like, just narrowly escaping the axe, and where a bird is narrowly escaping a hunter's gun, and where a child is just being repeatedly spanked. These are Matthew Gray Glubler clocks. I don't like them.
There's also the fact that right before the Blue Fairy shows up, as Geppetto and Figaro are getting ready for bed, and they're both getting in at the same time, and then Geppetto realizes, oh, Figaro, I forgot to open the window. So Figaro gets out from his bed, climbs up onto Geppetto's bed, climbs up the wall to the windowsill to open the window without thumbs. Even though Geppetto could have just sat up without getting out of bed to open the window himself.
And he later does so when he sees the Blue Fairy star. Our summary here is that Geppetto is ostensibly a kindly old man. However, he has clearly spent too much time with his puppets. He's very resourceful, though. He manages to survive inside of a whale.
Yeah, for a couple days. This film doesn't do a great job of keeping time, but I very much suspect this whole film happens in the course of about a week.
Which is honestly longer than some Disney movies, really.
Yeah, but the way they frame certain scenes makes it feel weird. There's such a strong connection between Geppetto and Pinocchio, but he spends more time away from Geppetto than he does with him. The strength of that bond doesn't really make any sort of sense. And so all those emotional beats that we're supposed to feel for are just kind of hollow.
Speaking of slightly hollow things, Jiminy Cricket is not a great conscience.
Yeah, he abandons Pinocchio at least two occasions.
He's very easily distracted, which, I mean, I get it. Like, he's kind of small. He probably can't hold a lot of thoughts in his head at once. That's how Tinkerbell's work. But repeatedly, he'll see something sexy and look away, and then Pinocchio will get captured. Like, he's Don from Buffy.
Two tangents I want to go on.
Sure.
One, he's also just a terrible cricket. He looks nothing like a cricket. I guess having a four-armed character would have been weird for a Disney film at this time, but Alice in Wonderland is not that far down the road, and they didn't have any problems with the caterpillar. There's also the fact that they sexualize every female character in this film.
Mm-hmm.
The Blue Fairy is sexualized by Jiminy. We've already talked about Cleo the fish.
The puppets?
Yeah, there's also the puppets in Stromboli's show, who are literal sex objects.
Mm-hmm.
The only non-sexualized female characters we get are mothers sending their school children off to school during the morning of the second day of the film, and the schoolgirls heading off and not getting sold to puppeteers or taken to a pleasure island.
And they're not really characters, they're more just like background set dressing that is alive.
Yeah.
Again, bringing the positivity. There are what had to have been very complicated shots to do where you are seeing things from Jiminy Cricket's perspective. So you're seeing people and objects from down below and they're very tall. And some of those shots look really good. And that's a fairly hard thing to do with animation because you're used to kind of this very eye-level rendering.
There's also some seafoam and waves during the scene where they're trying to escape Monstro that are really beautifully rendered. However, there's also this one thing that bothered me. There's this, in regards to the artistry, The art style shift that occurs with the Blue Fairy is really weird.
Yeah.
She's rendered about as photorealistically as you can get with cel-shaded animation at the time, but everyone else kind of feels like, you know, this came out of like a Mickey Mouse cartoon. Everyone's caricaturized. They've got large noses. A lot of them have gloved hands, harkening back to rubber hose style. And I get that this fairy is supposed to feel like otherworldly, but that art style does not communicate otherworldliness. It just communicates that we traced photo references of a female actress.
That said, they do a cool thing where she's sort of translucent, and that looks pretty cool. I think it's a good design choice to have her be kind of ethereal. So let's talk about how some of the horrible things you can do on pleasure islands, like smoking and vandalism and drinking and getting into fights and playing pool.
And I know that there's this association of pool with CD bars and criminals and stuff like that, but in the modern day, complaining about children playing pool seems just really, really old-fashioned. It's like the people who banned pinball because they thought it was gambling.
It does lead to the only thing that made us laugh out loud in this movie, sort of, indirectly. I want to talk about that scene, so it's in that scene. So Pinocchio makes a friend, Lampy, whatever, who is every Nebraska gay's first boyfriend when he gets to New York and later regrets it. And Lampy starts turning into a donkey, because that's how the island curse works, I guess. And Pinocchio sees the ear sprout up, looks at his beer, and just sets it aside like, nope, that too much. And that was a good joke. They had a really good one-er there.
Yeah, that was the only joke that both of us laughed at.
There were a few others. Like, there's this one bit where Jiminy Cricket is running around under some clockwork music box thing and keeps getting hit with the gears and gyros and stuff and says,
a lot of downbeats in there.
That made me laugh. And then you judged me for it.
I did.
And you were right to do so.
A lot of our criticisms so far have been kind of shallow, probably with the exception of the lack of any decent female characters in this.
Mm-hmm.
There's another more serious criticism for the film, and there's kind of this stark association that this film makes with poverty equaling criminality, or at least immorality. When Jiminy is first chosen to be Pinocchio's conscience, he gets a new set of clothes. Before this, he's in kind of ramshackle clothes. He's got no soles on his shoes, patches on his clothing, his hat is kind of falling apart. And then he gets a nice waistcoat, brand new shoes, umbrella, top hat, the works. And it's this subtle association with, well, in order to be a moral person, you have to look like you are a rich person. There's also the fact that a lot of the villains of the film are shown to be lower class. Honest John and his cat compatriot are in the same sort of rags that Jiminy was at the beginning of the film and are kind of just scrounging for scraps and coin and trying to make it. There's also Stromboli, who they describe using the G slur that we talked about in Hunchback of Notre Dame. And he is portrayed as this traveling performer, not lots of excess funds to go around. And then a lot of the naughty boys that we see are also kind of coded as lower class.
It's not necessarily universal. The Pleasure Island dude seems to be like relatively well off, but again, he's still meeting in seedy taverns. Red Lobster Tavern, actually. And which, whatever. And that kind of thing. So there's still this element of the underclass.
He's also specifically gained his wealth through trafficking children.
Yeah, not great.
I realize that we haven't really talked about the structure of the narrative yet. It's not strong. There are sort of three acts to this film. There's the initial setup and then Pinocchio being sold to Stromboli and escaping. Then there's him going to Pleasure Island and all the things that happen there and Jiminy going to find him. And then there's the third act where they get home and realize Geppetto's gone missing and go to save him. But the connective tissue between those three acts is almost non-existent. And much of Act 2 is kind of just a rehash of Act 1. Narratively, this film is just boring. Not a whole lot happens. There's not even a whole lot of character growth. It never really felt genuine to me that Pinocchio actually learned right from wrong. At pretty much every point of the film, he's just kind of doing whatever he wants to do. Jiminy even tries to stop him from going after Geppetto because it's too dangerous.
And it did technically turn out to be the right thing to do, but he didn't really learn anything from that. He just was brave.
Kind of lucked into passing the requirements for real boyness.
Mm-hmm. There are two underlying themes in this movie. That if you wish upon a star and wish really hard, it'll come true. And that exploiting children for profit is bad. Disney has kind of walked back both of those things. And that this is one of their foundational films, it's weird to see them change so much from that. Both in the whole, like, you have to work for what you wish for, which is a really good metaphor. That's one of my favorite parts of Princess and the Frog. They really get into how wishing is cool, but you have to work for your dreams too. On the other hand, Disney is well known for child actors and how those child actors don't always turn out well. Like, look at all the stuff that happened with Miley Cyrus and the Lizzie McGuire movie.
Some of the stuff that happened with Rowan Blanchard after Girl Meets World, how she felt unsafe on set.
Despite making narratives for children, they haven't always been great to children. And it's kind of weird to see this very pro-children narrative here.
I think that about does it for Pinocchio. Let's go ahead and move on to Chicken Little.
Yeah. This is a better movie.
It is a better movie.
It's a lazier movie, as yes. we talked about.
Whereas I would never consider Pinocchio lazy. Pinocchio is just kind of a product of its time, and it has not aged very well. Whereas this film came out just over a dozen years ago and is filled with pop culture references and cribbing from other movies. And the animation is definitely subpar. This is Disney's first attempt at 3D animation on their own. They literally just grabbed a bunch of their 2D animation people and set them on a 18-month course in Maya and said, here you go, make a movie.
Which is very cruel. Maya is hard to learn. It's not very user-friendly. You want to use like a 3ds Max or even an animation. Never mind.
But this film feels very lazy, or at least rushed.
Which is weird because they spent a good, 4 years in development?
The original story was conceived in late 2001, specifically September 2001, which honestly is pretty insightful for why the movie turned out the way it did.
Now that you bring that up, it makes a lot of sense. I can understand how wanting to grapple with the idea that the sky is falling would make sense for people at the time.
Then the script went through a number of revisions, eventually culminating in the plot that we got here. From the original Chicken Little and Abby Mallard / Ugly Ducklings, genders have both flipped. And instead of Chicken Little being away at summer camp to learn self-confidence and kind of deal with freaking out and being anxious, and then learning of some sort of plot by the camp counselor to destroy her hometown or whatever, we got the baseball thing and the alien invasion.
So I knew about the alien invasion thing before, because pop culture osmosis. I kind of wish I hadn't known going in, because I feel like if you don't know about that going in, and you're like, oh, this is some kind of Sandlot-y kind of thing, and then it just suddenly veers into a hard sci-fi, I'm like, oh, cool, that's fun. The sudden genre shift is a really fun thing we haven't seen a lot of from Disney, and I appreciate that.
I'd probably give them more props for it, but I remember a lot of the marketing happening for this film, and the alien invasion stuff was kind of plastered all over.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Well, I mean, War of the Worlds came out the same year, and there's also quite a bit of influence from this from 2002's Signs from M. Night Shyamalan, and I think they were kind of playing into cultural trends.
And I think going with some sort of alien invasion plot is kind of the best possible way to make Chicken Little as a thing into a whole-length movie. So I get that. They made the best choice there.
That's a pretty solid way to do that.
You could probably have a good 5 or 6 season-long thing called Falling Skies about an alien invasion and coping with that, and then finding another group of aliens who are also bad. Spoilers for Falling Skies.
This is very much a, not a product of its time, but a product of late 90s, early 2000s. Again, there's a lot of similarities here with Signs, War of the Worlds, not another teen movie?
A bit. It definitely has a lot of stories about kids being kids. Chicken Little has 3 friends, Ugly Duckling, Runt of the Litter, and Fish Out of Water, who are all exactly what you imagine them to be. But also, if you add on a layer of theater gay. Part of me felt like I was back at home with these kids singing along to various quintessential pop hits of the 80s and panicking and coping through media and having the one friend who's trying really hard to use psychology that she doesn't fully understand yet as a way to help people around her, and the one weird one who talks to aliens.
I love Fish Out of Water.
He's Fish Out of Water is so good.
Best character of this film. I would watch a movie just about him.
I don't think I would, because that character never works long term. That's why Pirates of the Caribbean 4 and 5 aren't very good.
That's fair.
But Fish Out of Water is really fun. He's kind of unperturbed by everything, finds everything delightful, kind of has a bit of a Stitch vibe to him. And he's just a fish in a diving helmet, which is amazing.
And he doesn't have any real lines of dialogue. He just kind of has these burbles.
Meanwhile, Ugly Duckling, she has a name, right?
Abby Mallard.
Abby Mallard, yes, thank you. Has this decent through line where she understands the problems that Chicken Little and his dad are having and is trying to get him to confront that directly head on, which is great. But then she also has a crush on Chicken Little through this whole thing, and then they kiss right before the climax, and then she's kind of useless for the rest of the movie. Why?
Admittedly, there's not a whole lot of movie left after that happens, but it's still noticeable.
And then, lastly, there's Runt of the Litter.
Runt of the Litter is every shitty fat joke that you can imagine shoved into a character.
Like, all of them. It's like a bingo list. We talked about how there's complicated fat stuff last week. This week is oof.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the typical fat character getting
stuck in a thing.
Fat character being a nervous eater, fat character being gross and disgusting.
It's not great, and it's frustrating when they made these two other good characters, Abby and Fish, who are really fun. And especially since Runt of the Litter is very queer-coded, his mom at one point grounds him by taking away his Streisand.
He has a Barbra Streisand collection, and that's his punishment for tagging along with Chicken Little and waking up the entire town for a fake alien invasion. And at the very climax of the film, he kind of gets a moment of actually being useful, whereas he's kind of been this lodestone throughout the rest of the narrative. He is driving a fire truck and is the one that helps Chicken Little, Kirby, and Buck up to City Hall. And he kind of comes into his own right as Abby becomes useless. So it kind of accentuates the shift there, and that's one of the reasons why Abby's character after that feels so low, and while there's a significant jump for Runt, it's kind of because they're changing roles and how useful they are to the plot.
And I do appreciate him driving the fire truck, but I don't appreciate the fact that he's, like, too big to fit into it, so he has to lean through the window.
Yeah, again, shitty fat stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And all of it is accentuated by this culture of systemic bullying throughout the entire town and school. Pretty much all of the friend group, with the exception of Fish out of water, suffer for it. I'm sure Fish does suffer, but Fish also just doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
But you have Chicken Little, who is very, very small and is trampled over when trying to get on the school bus and then has to run to school. His locker is on the second level of lockers, so has to use a rope and pulley system to open his locker and get his books and things like that. And also is small enough to be trapped in the locker, so he has a hanger in the locker in order to reach around and open the locker himself from the inside.
There is no disability access in Okie Oaks.
The kids during roll call specifically call Abby Ugly Duckling, even though that's not her name.
That's not my name.
And that's a big point of contention between Abby and resident mean girl Foxy Loxy.
I hate the names.
They're definitely reminiscent of the Mother Goose sort of folk tales that the original narrative comes from. Foxy Loxy, Lucy Goosey, Fuzzy Wuzzy, Runt of the Litter. Yeah. All that sort of stuff.
Okay, I'll give you that.
I will give you that Porcupine is dumb.
However, he's the coolest character in the movie. But you mean he's so cool. Got sunglasses.
He's just Poochie from The Simpsons. If you took Poochie and made him a porcupine instead and just shoved him in this movie, that's what you get. It's the laziest thing. But anyway, back to the systemic bullying.
It's not just in the classroom, which is to be expected. That's just how teen movies work.
But it's also the PE teacher and coach of the baseball team.
In a more self-aware movie, having a PE teacher shout,
"Split into two teams, popular versus unpopular."
That's amazing. That's a wonderful line, honestly.
If this was a more satirical movie, I wouldn't have batted an eye, but it does not handle all this stuff well. But again, the systemic bullying even goes out even further. The initial The Sky is Falling fiasco leaves Chicken Little being completely ostracized. He has a film that's being produced over the incident called The Crazy Little Chicken. Posters, billboards, bumper stickers, all of them reminding everyone of the incident and the catastrophe calls. Admittedly, there was a lot of property damage and everyone kind of freaked out, but they probably should have had some better warning system than some dude just ringing a bell for whatever reason.
I also want to point out that I'm pretty sure people died. So there's a bit where the bulb of the water tower falls off and rolls through the theater, which happens to be showing that one scene with The Rock from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Not Dwayne The Rock Johnson, the literal rock that chases Indiana Jones. And it's just that movie. It's not like an animal version of that movie. It's just Harrison Ford in a cave with a rock. Anyway, the water tower thing crashes through the theater, and I'm pretty sure people got flattened in that. The Crazy Little Chicken is the story of a tragedy along the lines of Final Destination 4.
I will give this movie props for trying to address some of the problems of toxic masculinity and men not being able to talk about their feelings, especially with their children or fathers or stuff like that.
I think that one of the most important things a kids' film can do is give kids and their parents social technologies to cope with things that they're going to have to deal with, like dealing with grief, dealing with new family members, dealing with separating family members, and here, dealing with men not being socially supposed to talk to each other about their feelings. And it handles it in a clumsy way. It hammers it into the ground. It has characters like shoving magazines at each other, like, say, talk to your dad. But it does, in the end, tell you how to work through that, and that is the emotional arc for the movie.
Sometimes the movie can just act as that icebreaker for those sorts of conversations and be successful. It's very heavy-handed here, but there's also the fact that on some level it needs to be heavy-handed, because unless it's obvious, people aren't going to catch it, especially the men that need that the most.
Yeah, definitely.
But I'm not going to say that it's necessarily well-handled or couldn't have been handled better than it is.
I think it's also slightly frustrating that the alien dad is also not great at talking to his kids, not great at opening up about emotions and stuff. It's kind of treated as, well, that's just guys being guys. That's how guys are.
Yeah, goofy sitcom dad.
All, which on the one hand, yes, it is a frequent problem and I understand what they're going for, but there isn't presented as, oh, this is a atypical thing that needs to be addressed. It's just, this is just something that everybody goes through. This is a normal kid thing.
One other odd thing that is also just very indicative of the time period this film came out in, the opening of the film starts off with Buck kind of reading, oh, Once Upon a Time. It's like, oh, God, this.
How many times have you heard that to begin a story? Let's do something else.
And then they show the beginning of The Lion King. With the beginning of Circle of Life. It's like,
no, I don't think so. It sounds familiar, doesn't it to you?
And then it cuts to the storybook opening and reading from that, like,
oh, no, not the book. How many have seen opening the book before? Close the book. We're not doing that.
This film is trying really hard to not be your typical Disney film. It has not aged well at all.
Disney needs to stop making fun of itself for being Disney. That's what it's best at.
And then there's probably the biggest problems with the film. So during the alien invasion, there's lasers shooting off everywhere and then everything disintegrates, but they are just kind of trapped on the alien ship. They're not dead. And Foxy Loxy is one of the people who gets hit with the lasers and reconstituted in the holding cell and then later is brought back again. But apparently during the process, there was some, as the film says,
she got a brainwave's little scramble during reconstitution, but
and
it's like that one episode of Star Trek with a transporter malfunction when they all got put into the holodeck and thought that they were, like, in a gangster movie.
Kind of like that. And the alien police officer is like,
no worries, we can put her back the way she was.
And I'm not sure if it's just Runt of the Litter or it's everyone that's kind of gathered around. It says,
no, she's perfect.
Throughout most of the film, Foxy has been your stereotypical mean girl, instigating a lot of bullying.
Imagine Angelica from Rugrats, but as a fox.
Yeah, and after the brain scrambling, she's dolled up in pink, blonde ringlets coming down, and is this sort of Southern Belle archetype. And then her and Runt kind of start a relationship, if the credits are to be believed, because they're saying this duet. And it's, yes, Foxy has been terrible and mean. And yes, Runt probably deserves nice things, but Runt does not deserve a person via completely removing their agency of personality from them. It's super gross.
It's the kind of thing that whole arcs of Dollhouse and probably Westworld have gotten into.
Prior to this, the film is just kind of par for the course of what I expect. But this just kind of comes out of left field, and it's the very end of the film almost, and it just kind of pulls you out of wherever you're at, and it's just, ew, that's disgusting.
And I mean, I get it. I feel like probably a lot of kids have wished they could just turn their high school bully into a nice person. But there's a difference between wanting that as a thing and actually doing it.
Yeah, usually that change comes from communication, understanding, and actual character growth as opposed to just a magic pill. All right, I think it's time to choose one of these films to move on, since we have to.
Yeah, Chicken Little scrapes ahead. I think that Pinocchio has some things going for it, and there are a lot of things that Chicken Little is doing really badly, like the Foxy Loxy stuff and the fat jokes, but there is something here that is worth extracting, and Pinocchio is less so, I think.
I would agree. Chicken Little is my vote to move on this week, even though it has some really crappy stuff going on. While the narrative is kind of all over the place, it's still better than what Pinocchio's got going on.
What's up next week? Because that's our last episode, isn't it?
It's not our last episode, okay. But it is the final match in round one of our bracket, which means after that week, we're going to be discussing films that we've already talked about once before. But next week is kind of the perfect way to cap off round one. It's Tangled versus Frozen.
Finally, a mashup that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. It's a little weird that one of these films is going to get cut in round one, but I mean, we said the same thing with Beauty and the Beast and Mulan.
Yeah.
So that should be a very interesting episode. I'm definitely looking forward to that one. And if you are looking forward to it, please remember to like and subscribe. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and of course Podbean. Until then, we should still have the poll up for our previous episode for you folks to determine what moves on, whether it is Zootopia or The Little Mermaid. We should have the results for that by the end of next episode, and we'll announce that then.
Thanks so much for your participation. It helps a lot. And going forward, we're going to have some harder mashups that might be harder to decide. So we might call on you again.
But until then, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. Thank you for tuning in.